Welcome to the first of a series of interviews with Northeast Corridor leaders about the busiest rail corridor in North America. I am your host, Mitch Warren, Executive Director of the Northeast Corridor Commission. We're fortunate to have Roger Harris, the departing president of Amtrak, join us as our first guest. Roger reflected on his 7 years at Amtrak and discussed issues including the strong ridership growth that Amtrak has experienced in recent years, aging infrastructure and on-time performance challenges, and the importance of the investments made possible by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, among other topics. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the interview. Roger, thank you for being our inaugural guest in what is the opposite of inaugural, your penultimate week at Amtrak. We appreciate you taking the time out of what I'm sure is a very busy final few weeks to join us. So just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. How did you end up at Amtrak after a career in the aviation industry?
Thanks, Mitch, and thanks for inviting me here today. It's an honor to be here. I guess I have transportation in my veins. I've worked trains, planes, and automobiles. My first job first service job was in the automotive industry. And really loved that. I did that because I like cars. I graduated from college with a degree in finance, and I thought, wow, what am I going to do with this? And banking sound kind of boring. So I just went with my passion. I worked in the auto industry and then found it kind of restrictive because one of the things about the auto industry is the product cycles are really long. And so it takes a long time to see the fruits of your labor. And I went into the airline business, graduating from grad school. And that's the complete opposite, where you can change your business in a day, literally in a deregulated environment. And so incredibly dynamic. And then I came to the railroad industry, which is a little bit more like the automotive, which is it takes a long time to get stuff done, but it's equally rewarding. It's kind of a different dimension.
What, coming from the airline industry, what surprised you the most about Amtrak, about the rail industry?
What surprised me is how similar it is. Like, it, at least kind of on the commercial customer side, it is almost identical. And it's been a historical issue, I think, that, you know, people think that running a passenger railroad is about running trains. And I would posit that it's not. It's about serving customers and getting customers from where they are to where they want to be. And that is no different than an airline at all. And the fact is that many of the ways in which we serve them are identical. The way we understand their travel needs, the way we price the product, the way we sell the product, the way we serve them in our departure points, in our, you know, our stations versus airports, like, there's not that much difference. Train stations are more convenient because we do security in a different way. On board, you know, both modes of transportation have onboard service. They have the captain of the ship, as it were. So, you know, all these things revolve around the customer. And so that's what this is. I don't think this is about trains. And of course, trains are very important because that's what we operate to take care of our customers. But at the core, it's about the customer.
Well, speaking of the customer, before you became president of Amtrak, you were the chief commercial officer. And Amtrak has seen really amazing growth in ridership. You've now exceeded pre-COVID ridership levels by quite a bit on the Northeast Corridor in particular. Just curious about, both from your experience as chief commercial officer and as president, what is it that Amtrak has done to get this kind of ridership growth on the corridor, and how have things changed sort of pre-COVID to post-COVID in terms of what the riders look like and what your marketing strategies have been?
So, first of all, I would have to say it's not all about us. I think that there's been sort of a generational social change in this country where people have opened their eyes to the attractiveness and possibility of passenger rail. That's very broad. And I don't think that's about us. I just think that's about changes in the economy. I think it's about congestion. So the more we build and the more congestion we get in our roads, et cetera, the more attractive passenger rail becomes. I think people have been concerned about the environment. I also think that people have increasingly traveled more internationally. International travel is, you know, in the last 30 years has grown tremendously. And people have seen it done well in Western Europe, in Asia, and other places. And so they have a benchmark and they come back from those travels and they say, you know, why don't we have that? There is this sort of, you know, basic demand out there that we have that we can, I don't want to say exploit, but we can develop. And if you look at some really great statistics between pre-COVID and now, and you see that Amtrak has grown as a system 20% since 2019, and the Northeast Corridor has grown 30%, and Northeast Regional has grown 45%, and North Carolina travel, Amtrak in North Carolina has grown almost 60%, and Virginia 70%. Like, these are eye-popping. And if you look at vehicle miles traveled in this country, it's basically not grown. It's very small single digits since 2019. And domestic air travel, if you look at TSA screens, it's grown high single digits. And that's relative to those numbers that I just quoted. So anyway, there's been this huge increase in demand, which you rightfully cited. What have we done? Well, I think we've just become much more pragmatic in terms of our pricing. So versus pre-COVID, business travel is still down 20-30%. Now, the airlines will tell you that. We see it on our Acela product. Acela previously was almost purely a business product, and we priced it like that. So it was very hard to get a reasonable fare on Acela. And we just took a far more pragmatic view to say, look, we're going to try to manage buy down as much as possible. And we find ways to offer more tickets at lower prices to generate more demand and get more people onto the product. So we did that. We also introduced a lot of, I think, innovative lower price points like the Night Owl fares, where we were not really worried about generating revenue. We were trying to develop utility, travel utility, where we had an otherwise empty seat where we said, look, you know, let's get somebody in that seat because we're creating value for our stakeholders, the country at large. You know, so those were ways in which I think we just became far more creative on the commercial side. And at the same time, the operations and scheduling side became far more creative in terms of turning trains more efficiently and getting more out of our assets, because until this year, we've had basically no new capacity in decades. And so we created all of this growth with very, very little incremental capacity. So, you know, it's true that in the Midwest, we took delivery of our venture car fleet that largely replaced the Horizon equipment that was grounded for some corrosion concerns. But until these new Acelas came last August, we really have had very little incremental capacity. And even with those new trains, we've been retiring the old ones. So a lot out there and a lot of, I think, far more creative marketing. We have, you know, really gone to where the customer is and created a lot of excitement around train travel. If you look at our social media, you'll see we've won a lot of plaudits for doing some really cool stuff.
When you've done it, and you mentioned this challenging environment with the old Acelas having to take some of those out of service as they aged, the new Acelas were delayed a couple of years and now are beginning to transition in. Those are somewhat different trains. They're longer trains, can carry more passengers. You're going to have more of them than the old Acelas. How does that influence your ability to grow going forward? And maybe also talk about the Aero trains that are coming to replace the regionals.
You know, it's very exciting to have this new equipment. It has been a lot of work to get them inducted into the service. They are the first equipment in that generation of TGV product from Alstom. So it's their fifth generation high-speed train. And, you know, there are always, I think, challenges with new technology and new products. So it hasn't been what we want it to be yet, but we're working on it. We're making progress. You're right. They're bigger. So, you know, each frequency, each departure has the opportunity for more seats. That, you know, while I wouldn't promise that it brings down prices, it brings down the, it creates the ability to create more demand through more creative pricing because you have more seats, right? So you have to do more work to fill up the train. So, you know, that's one thing. But I think that it is the real chance to expose the traveling public to a really world-class modern product, which should over time, you know, really build more support for what we're doing here and providing modern transportation. I see the Acela is really catering more to what we call the on-spine traffic. So between Boston, Washington, where we have these large cities that have a lot of inner city travel, if you have more capacity, you're going to be able to cater to more of the market. And the Aeros really with their dual mode functionality, where they have both catenary equipment to pick up overhead electrification on the corridor. They also have a diesel power plant to generate power for traction off corridor. You know, they're going to make it far more seamless for us to bring trains from places like North Carolina and Virginia, upstate New York, et cetera, directly onto the corridor. And so the Aeros will not only provide a replacement for the Northeast regional capacity on the spine, but they will also improve the accessibility of these regional markets onto the corridor. And when I say that, part of, you know, not only is it a very seamless service for the customers, but it's a better experience. Because today, when we have trains coming from off corridor onto the corridor, the passengers have to sit in Washington, D.C. or New Haven while we change the engine. And changing the engine takes like over half an hour, and it requires disconnecting electricity so we can, you know, hook up the new power source. That means there's no electricity on the train for, you know, at least 10 minutes. And that means no lights, no Wi-Fi, no air conditioning, no toilets, which is not a good situation, but it's out of necessity today. But these new Aeros will make that transition seamless. So, you know, big improvement in the customer experience.
Yeah, they're really nice trains. I had the opportunity when they were at Union Station to walk through them, and beautiful trains, something I'm very excited to see on the corridor starting in 2027, right?
On the corridor, yeah. We expect them. So they're the first eight of the Aero orders were diesel only, and therefore service on the Cascades and Pacific Northwest. We expect to be launching that service in just a couple of months. So that's really riding upon us. And then the rest of the order will be for the Northeast, and those will all be dual mode in one way or another. And so they require a little bit more testing and certification than those initial diesel units did. So that's what's going on at the moment. We have the first, I think, three of those dual modes. They've been in Colorado for testing, then they'll be here for acceptance.
One of the things that is, I'm sure, challenging when it comes to growing ridership is on-time performance. You have very old infrastructure that we'll talk about, and old rolling stock, which you're in the process of replacing, which have both contributed to delayed trains, canceled trains, tough on-time performance statistics. What impact does that have? What can you do both in the near term to try and address that, you know, aside from rebuilding the infrastructure and replacing the rolling stock? And then what can you do in the longer term to begin to address that, to make sure people have the most reliable service possible when traveling on the corridor?
Great question. Look, I tell the team all the time, people do not buy, well, by and large, people do not buy a ticket to ride on the train. They buy a ticket to get somewhere by a time certain. And that's our obligation. And so we should never get confused that is the most important reason people ride on us. We should also be really clear that when we look at customer satisfaction, there is almost a complete correlation between on-time performance and customer satisfaction. It trumps every other aspect of service delivery. by far. I mean, it is, you know, things like food and beverage and employee friendliness don't matter relative to on-time performance, basically. I kind of exaggerate, but I think it's really true. I think we don't, there are so many factors that go into on-time performance, not just what we do, but the weather and, you know, uncontrollable events. I've been spending a lot of time on customer communication because what we found is we don't always know what's going to go wrong. We can't always fix it, but customers really want to know what's going on. And even though we may interrupt the travel plans and we still have an obligation to get them to where they're going, they are far more sympathetic if they know why and what's going on and what to expect. So I think the first thing is communication. And we have spent a huge amount of time and effort in improving our communication channels and looking for different ways to communicate with people, whether it's text or push notifications or email or X or just onboard announcements. So a lot of investment in that and a lot of effort to make it the same message, because one of the things we found is different people get different messages. So we want to get the accurate information out there to our employees and the traveling public. But when it comes to managing the events, we're well down the road of developing a new operation control center, much like you would find in many airlines where a lot of the operation of the company is centralized in one place. We have a facility today in Wilmington, which is does a really good job with what it has, but the ambition of the new one, which is also in Wilmington, is much greater in terms of the functions that it brings together. And the purpose of that and the way it helps customers is it brings all the decision makers in one place in real time with the tools they need to improve the experience of the delay, to either shorten it or make it better or get help. We have a ton of incredibly dedicated employees out there who do a great job of trying to fix problems when they occur, but they could do a way better job if they had the resources of a 23,000 person organization behind them to help. And so that's really what that's about. So the operation, the Unified Operation Control Center will be up and running for stages next year. It'll be a real important improvement. And then in terms of making improvements to equipment and infrastructure, a lot of it is prioritizing what is most urgent and which we can actually accomplish quickly. So we have been looking at what's really important, what to do, rather than, I think in the past, it was a rather esoteric exercise to figure out, okay, well, how old is stuff and should we replace it yet? No, we're really looking now at like, okay, how much longer will that last? Like, what is the right prioritization? And that kind of sometimes scrambles your priorities, but I think it helps you focus on what's really important. And there's some stuff that just goes on behind the scenes that no one has an appreciation for how complicated it is. Like our electrification system on the corridor, people love to talk about catenary, which is the overhead wires that provide the power for the trains, as you know. But that is sort of the 5% last mile of getting the power to the train. People don't understand that we have a hydro plant in Pennsylvania that generates substantial amount of our electricity, that we have converter facilities that then take that power, modify it for consumption on the system, that we buy commercial power on other parts of the corridor, that we have hundreds of millions of dollars of equipment that processes that electricity before we can even deliver it to the trains. And so we have, you know, probably $1 billion worth of investment in stuff that no one ever sees that's behind all that sort of not even customer facing electrification, but the stuff that people know what to talk about. So anyway, there's just so much going on that, you know, is not really that well understood, but it kind of has to happen every day and people only ever learn about it if it doesn't work. And the fact that they don't know about it, I think is an incredible endorsement to how well it works. It just is old and it needs to be replaced.
Well, on the topic of rebuilding the old infrastructure that Amtrak inherited, Amtrak was given the Northeast Corridor, or at least most of it, in 1976.
It was not in a state of good repair at the time. The freight railroads that owned it previously had hard times for decades prior to that, really hadn't been investing in it. They went bankrupt. Amtrak eventually took it over, but had very little funding for many years, relied on the annual appropriations process, which gave you enough to get by each year, but you never got enough to go back and really rebuild and modernize that infrastructure. So a few years ago, a game changer was the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which passed Congress in 2021. And that provided for the Northeast Corridor about $30 billion to begin to rebuild the corridor. But for the first time, you had multi-year funding that you could invest. So you knew more than at the beginning of each year what you're going to have. You could plan for a number of years. Can you talk about what this bill has meant, some of the challenges that you've faced in ramping up the investments, going from 0 to 60 in a few years where you were relying on annual appropriations, suddenly got, this influx of multi-year funding to invest, and talk a little bit about the challenges of spending it and some of what you've been able to do with it to begin to rebuild the corridor. It's a long way to go, but it's been an important investment. I want to get your take on it.
Yeah, it's been absolutely enormous and, a huge opportunity. Historically, Amtrak was criticized for some of its capital projects, justifiably so, but in some ways unfairly, because many of these big major capital investments require many years of planning and certainty, especially when it comes to the ways to fund it. And so many of the projects in the past were stop-start, are we going to have funding or are we not going to have funding? And that makes it really difficult. And what the IIJA allowed us to do is plan. And I think for the first time, really have the certainty to see a project through. And that has been a game changer. Now, there are other, we've bought together many other sources of funding to get all this capital work done. But in general, it was the certainty, the 5 years of funding, and of course, the projects go much longer. But when we saw the work ahead of us, we built out a capital delivery team with capabilities in terms of cost estimation, project management, project controls, the things that really large professional construction companies have to manage the risks of projects. We didn't have that before. We couldn't afford it. And we built this infrastructure. And when you look at the amount of capital work going on today, we're spending $500 million a month on capital investment across different asset categories. But when you look at that, we have one of the largest capital project portfolios going on in one place in the world today with all these projects. And, and we're not doing it alone. So we should also remember that many of our partners on the Northeast Corridor and close to the corporate Northeast Corridor are also building these huge projects, often in cooperation with us. So New Jersey Transit took the lead on Portal North Bridge, which we recently opened the first track of. That was a great success. Our partners at New York MTA are building Penn Station Access on the east side of New York. Connecticut is building Walk Bridge in Connecticut. New York State is building, it's not on the Northeast Corridor, but the Livingston Avenue Bridge in Albany, that's very close. But, these huge projects are underway. And they are transformational, and yet they are making up for lost time because they're not actually moving the state of the art. They're just kind of making up for the 70 years of missed opportunity that was there in terms of investment. But the certainty of funding is what allows us to manage the cost properly and deliver projects on as close as possible to on time and on budget. There are very often unforeseen conditions in these projects that are making up for 100-year-old assets. But I think the team has been doing an incredible job of managing risk and getting the best value for the money.
Yeah, a lot of critical projects moving forward, a lot of Amtrak projects, and as you mentioned, a lot of projects by New York MTA and Connecticut and New Jersey Transit and other agencies along the corridor. This was 5 years of funding, and FY22 through fiscal year 2026, the funding is running out. We will see if it will continue or not, depending on what Congress does with the next authorization bill. But obviously, this was a great start, but there's a lot of critical projects that you need to do going forward.
If more money were provided, what are some key projects that and key improvements you need to make to the corridor that continue to allow for better, more reliable, faster, more frequent train service?
So, we have some projects that are fully funded that are critical. And so they're underway. You know, it's absolutely wonderful to have those. We've had to make some tough decisions. There are some projects like the Susquehanna River Bridge, which is really important, which has hopefully most of its funding. But depending on, you know, when you look at what happened with IIJA and the huge slug of opportunity it created for doing capital investment, it also created a lot of inflation in the construction industry in the Northeast. So we've had to manage through what had been cost estimates, that were based on, you know, even potentially pre-COVID conditions, suddenly trying to be escalated to the current environment. And what we thought was enough money just is not for this condition. And it's not even a Northeast corridor. It's a global condition for commodities that are very difficult. So, you know, there's the funding of some of the projects that are underway, but I would say the most critical project we have that isn't funded, which needs to be, is the Sawtooth Bridge in New Jersey, which not a lot of people are aware of, but it is the structure just east of Newark, between Newark and the North River Tunnel going under the Hudson, where the Northeast Corridor crosses over multiple other tracks, including PATH and some non-Northeast Corridor New Jersey Transit services. And it's 100 years old, and it desperately needs to be replaced because there's the risk of concrete falling from the structure. Because the Northeast Corridor actually crosses over the non-Northeast Corridor New Jersey Transit tracks. And if we don't get that funded and built, there's a real risk that not only the Northeast Corridor could be shut down, but all the New Jersey Transit services coming from that part of New Jersey would be as well. So, you know, Sawtooth is the one that I'm most concerned about.
Yeah, and it's not just the bridges and tunnels. There's critical bridges like Sawtooth. There's in Connecticut, Devon, Itatuck, Koskob, and you have Bush and Gunpowder in Maryland. But then there's also the basic infrastructure. And now you guys are trying to rebuild the signal system, modernize them, the signal system, so you can run more trains and faster trains and the ET structures and all of that. A lot of work, just basic infrastructure work that needs funding so you guys can do that in the most efficient way possible.
Yeah, and that comes back to what I said about prioritization. And, you know, so there's some asset categories or some, you know, features of the infrastructure that have popular attention, but they're not always the most important thing. They're not the most critical thing. And so one of, I think, the most exciting things that we've done in our capital delivery group is, on the engineering side, where we've become more open-minded in terms of how to look at this holistically, look at where the risks are in the entire infrastructure portfolio, so that we can do the smartest thing first.
And right now, Amtrak is undergoing in the middle of a pretty big initiative. You guys are talking about restructuring the company, and I know you're in the middle of a lot of work, so you're limited in what you can say about it. But is there anything you want to say just in terms of the reason for all the work that's happening all the discussions that are happening on restructuring and where you think that might be leading you.
Yeah, I mean, this topic came up at the beginning of the year and in discussions with the DOT. And, you know, after a little bit of thought, we realized, hey, you know, this is a great opportunity to improve some of the processes that we have in the company. We just talked at the beginning of the hour about the incredible amount of growth that Amtrak has seen in terms of ridership in the last 5-6 years, I guess 7 years. And we reflected on the fact that trying hard can only get you so far. Like you can, yeah, there's been just incredible amount of effort by so many people in the organization, but you can't just work harder all the time. You've got to start being smarter. And so part of this restructuring is about focusing around activities more rather than having a lot of people have thought that Amtrak has kind of a confusing structure and, you know, maybe it isn't clear where sort of the infrastructure lives versus the rolling stock versus the operation. And so, you know, the idea of this effort is to bring more focus and accountability around those critical activities and also improve the way we work together, because internally we work really hard and it is the most dedicated group of people I've ever worked with. There is a passion for this business. It is a mission-driven company. But I think sometimes we succeed only because we tried so hard, and that we could have done even more through more clarity of responsibility and decision-making and faster decision-making. So that's part of what we want to get out of the restructuring as well, is to improve the ability of the organization to deliver by getting rid of some of the kind of unnecessary kind of swirling goes on in some of the decision making that we have today.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's end with a few quick Q&As. Tell us, what do you see as Amtrak's biggest accomplishment in relation to the Northeast Corridor over the past 7 years when you've been here?
Well, I had two.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so, well, one is just that growth. I mean, you know, Mitch, to have grown Northeast region by 45% in a world where VMTs are almost flat, like, I don't even know, like, how to describe how transformational that is. And what's really interesting, a fact that I didn't bring up is, I was talking about creativity and pricing. It's an incredible fact that 60% of the people traveling on the Northeast Corridor now are traveling on a lower fare than existed pre-COVID.
Wow.
So we have made this in volume. And so we've introduced a tremendous amount of customers to railroad travel in the U.S. And, you know, our challenge is to keep them. But if it's so, the other thing I wanted to answer is, I think that we have tried very hard to communicate and work with our partners better, and it hasn't always been easy. But I think you've seen the results of getting stuff done. Part of it is, I think we've earned their respect in the quality of work we've done with this incredible capital delivery group that we've set up, and I like to believe that the respect and communication will only lead to better results in the future.
What concerns you the most about the future of the Northeast Corridor?
What concerns me is that our success in delivering these projects today, in very large part, comes down to the incredible capital delivery group we created, and to not have the funding to continue the amount of work that we have today would really risk being able to keep that capability together. And so we need the certainty of funding. We need the funding so that we can get the work done and we can get it done efficiently.
Yeah, we've seen all the work Amtrak has done to get to the point where you can effectively invest all that money. And we've seen the ramp up in spending
It's really been amazing to watch, and hopefully that can continue when we don't go backwards. What makes you most optimistic about the future of the Northeast Corridor?
I think all the attention, sometimes it's like a real pain, but the attention we get. And when I say attention, with it comes accountability, but the fact that we're in the news, that people want to travel on us, that people, like it's no fun, but the criticism we get for failures, it comes with the territory, but it means people care. And it's absolutely amazing the number of complaints I get that say, I love Amtrak. I just want to let you know about how you let me down or how you could be better. People care enough to write. And, I know we're not perfect and I know we can be better, but it is a community asset. And, we have a duty of care to look after the asset, our customers, and deliver really good service.
And what's next for you? You're going to go take a very long nap when this is done. That is, you have a tough job. And you really enjoy some time off.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the job. It's been, a tremendous honor, and it's interesting. And I love helping people. I love getting out in the field, listening to people, figuring out how I can make things better. But it is, kind of exhausting. And I want to take a little bit of time off to travel and figure out what I want to do next, because I certainly am not someone who likes to sit home for extended periods of time. I know I'll do something different, but I've done these pivots several times in my career, and I've always found it very rewarding and energizing. And, I look forward to it.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your work at Amtrak over the past 7 years, your leadership over the past few years, your leadership on the Northeast Corridor Commission, where I've enjoyed getting to know you and working with you. It's been really great. We'll miss you, but good luck. And I'm sure you will enjoy your time off and some travel.
Thank you, Mitch. And thanks for your leadership of the Northeast Corridor Commission. I think it's an incredibly important function. There are many stakeholders. It's complicated. There's a lot of work that goes into getting to yes. And, I just want to thank you guys for doing that.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you.